So the learning objective for this snack is to develop individualized treatment plans for patients with psoriatic arthritis that weigh the risks and benefits of newer agents. Joel, could you take a minute and talk a little bit about the efficacy and safety of some of the agents that we're using in both psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis?
Yeah, so I think starting off with sort of biologic molecules, we need to recognize that there's good variation in the response rate in the skin. Sometimes that variation is not seen as much in the joints. Interesting. So let's take TNF inhibitors, for example. Some of our higher efficacy TNF inhibitors in the skin are things like adalimumab, certolizumab, and infliximab, all FDA approved for both skin disease and joint disease. And they tend to be more effective than, say, etanercept. Whereas in the joint disease space, those TNF inhibitors tend to have fairly similar or comparable efficacy. Moving on to other mechanisms of actions, we have IL-17 inhibitors, which have very high efficacy rates in the skin. And two of them, ixekizumab and secukinumab, are also approved for psoriatic arthritis. We don't know for certain if they are as effective as TNF inhibitors. I'd be curious to hear what both of your clinical experiences are, but at least their ACR response rates seem to hint that they may have TNF-like benefits. What do you think of that? Is that something that you think is comparable, or?
Jen?
I do, actually. I think we do see that in clinical practice. I think they, as a rheumatologist, it's hard to talk about ACR 20s because if I only had a 20% improvement on these treatment measures, I think my patients would be quite angry with me. But I think that the newer agents have, their skin clearance is amazing, and really the joint improvement, I think, parallels the TNFs.
Yeah.
Well, Jennifer raises an entirely different comment, which is to what extent the outcome measures we use in clinical trials can be used in clinical practice. And I think you politely were hinting at the fact that the ACR 20 is useless in clinical practice because no one kind of looks for the 20% improvement, and no one does those measures. We do other outcome measures like the CDI or what have you, so not the ones that we necessarily see in clinical trials to extrapolate. But obviously, when we think about what we're going to use, it would be nice if we only had one patient, one problem. Mm-hmm. But we're often using these agents in patients who have other things that they're seeing other doctors besides the rheumatologist and dermatologist for. What are the concerns that we should have about using biologic therapy or small molecule therapy or targeted synthetics, Jennifer, in patients with comorbidities?
Absolutely. The question really should be also, you know, are there different other diseases that this agent can treat? Because if you can hone the therapy such that it would treat their psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis, and another comorbid medical condition, that might be better than trying to put that patient on two or three different agents together.
Joel, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think, Ockham's razor, one drug better than two is often what we try to do.
Ockham, Sir William of Ockham.
Exactly, So I think that's really a way to think about this problem. And we know for some of our therapies, it has both benefits and potential harms. So patients who have a history of demyelinating disease, Guillain-Barré or optic neuritis or multiple sclerosis, you're going to favor non-TNF strategies in those patients. So we have very good options now of therapies like IL-17 inhibitors, IL-12 or 23 inhibitors, which don't have any adverse effects on those conditions. Actually, some early preliminary data suggests that maybe some benefit of IL-17 inhibitors in demyelinating diseases like multiple sclerosis, although it's really not, it's not ready yet for certain. It needs to be more phase 3 trials to understand if it's going to have a benefit for MS, but certainly no evidence of harm in that situation.
Gee, what does it mean when an agent that we use for a condition causes one of the same conditions that we use to treat the agent with? Jennifer, what do you think about it?
It's interesting, isn't it? So we definitely see this in our rheumatoid arthritis patients, where we start them on a medication such as a TNF, and the next thing we know, they have psoriasis, which really sounds counterintuitive, but can happen, and we see that a lot in clinical practice. So in that case, it may be worth it to switch mechanisms of actions so that we don't cause an additional problem.
I think it shows how complicated human biology is, right? So if part of the reason why we know so much about TNF inhibitors is they were tried in so many different disease states. You know, they were tried for sepsis. We thought it would help people with sepsis. We thought it would help people with congestive heart failure because TNF is elevated in those conditions. They thought it would work for multiple sclerosis. And that's how we know this information so well. And it's to the benefit of our patients because we have this added knowledge now. A similar story sort of has emerged with the IL-17 inhibitors. We really thought, based on all the basic science data, that they should be very effective for inflammatory bowel disease. And they really haven't borne out to be effective for that condition. In some cases, they seem to exacerbate underlying inflammatory bowel disease. So typically speaking, patients who have active Crohn's or ulcerative colitis probably going to move away from IL-17s and try and use either TNFs or IL-12-23 used to ecanemab, which often is approved in both indications.
So another thing we could spend a minute discussing is, are there any absolute or relative thou shalt nots? In other words, if a patient has one condition, does that really push you to choosing one agent over another in terms of not worsening that condition? I'm thinking, for example, of, as you alluded to, patients with uncontrolled CHF, we probably should stay away from the TNFs in their therapy. Any others that we should be thinking about, Jennifer?
Definitely demyelinating conditions. I would bring up the limits in terms of depression and apremilast. That's definitely one that we can comment on. And I mean, for people who have severe GI intolerances, we really might want to stay away from oral agents. Injectable medications may be the proper road today for them.
I've generally found that when I have patients who have significant intolerance to non-steroidals, that's almost a flashing neon light as to what they may are likely to experience with oral agents.
Yeah, so we need to be cognizant that your older patient may be more prone to dehydration effects of GI intolerance, and that's a special population we'll be careful for with some of the oral agents.
But what about patients who have other kinds of skin lesions, like non-melanotic skin cancers, also, unfortunately, too common in the population.
That's right.
What are the kinds of things we should be using or not using?
Yeah, so I think there's no hard and fast rules here. We're fortunate we have more data on the TNF inhibitors than we do on the other mechanisms of actions that have been around longer. That data seems to suggest that patients have a slightly higher rate of non-melanoma skin cancer on TNF inhibitors. And certainly what you'll see in clinical practice sometimes is that some patients develop skin cancers in crops, if you will. You know, they'll have 4 or 5 squamous cells, 6 or 7 basal cells. Those are the patients, when they've had more than 1 or 2, it's time to start thinking, well, maybe this unique individual is more prone to having development of skin cancers on this MOA, and maybe I need to think about changing to a different MOA.
So I'm curious, there are a number of so-called pre-malignant conditions. Should we be having the same index of suspicion for pre-malignant conditions as for malignant conditions?
So these are situations where people have a lot of actinic keratoses, for example, sun damage. We know those people are at higher risk for developing skin cancers, be they melanoma, squamous cell carcinomas, basal cell carcinomas over time. But I don't think we have enough data to definitively know that there's a real benefit of drug A versus drug B to really guide us at this point in time.
Jennifer, your thoughts?
I agree. In terms of other things that you would think about, looking at the patient as a whole, the other question is are there other comorbid conditions such as hypercholesterolemia that we'd have to worry about? Do they have an underlying connective tissue disease? All of those things play into what agent you choose.
Yeah, and it's certainly relevant, I think, that the last iteration of the GRAPPA guidelines, for example, suggested not only should you be choosing your agents predicated on what the phenotype of disease is, but what the comorbidity background is of the patient in whom that phenotype of disease is expressing itself.
Yeah. I think a really interesting topic for us, since we have a multidisciplinary group here, is the emergence of IL-12-23 inhibitors potentially for lupus. And so there's some initial trial data suggesting some potential benefit for lupus with a drug like ustekinumab. And our patients who have psoriasis and lupus are some of the most challenging people to treat because many of our therapies for psoriasis, such as ultraviolet light, we really can't use. And people with lupus, the TNF inhibitors, have a mixed record in that state. So these are really challenging patients, and I think it's an important reason why to stay tuned and keep on eating your snacks because we keep on learning more every day.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.